And the number of lives that were saved as a result of that statement, just that one statement, can't really even be quantified at this point, because I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for that one moment that will stay with me for the rest of my life.
Hi, everybody. It's Linda. It has been quite a week. This is the week that the plot to kidnap and possibly kill Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer and overthrow the government of Michigan, this was the week that that plot was uncovered. It's astonishing, yet the experts say that we can expect to see more domestic terrorism before we see less. There are literally hundreds of domestic terrorism cases under review right now. I started thinking about who I could talk to about this topic, and the name Jesse Morton came to mind. I've actually interviewed Jesse a couple of times before. Jesse is a former recruiter for Al-Qaeda, and he now works with NYPD and other groups, including his own parallel networks, to combat hate and violent extremism. Jesse has a rather unique perspective, literally having gone from one extreme to the other, and he has a deep and profound understanding of the impact of dehumanization. One side dehumanizes the other and vice versa, and there's nowhere to go but violence. We have to stop it. We have the power to stop it. Jesse is going to share his own experience and some real life hands-on tips about how you can engage with those with whom you disagree. So take a moment, please, listen to this conversation, and then go out and talk to someone with empathy and show some love, even when you don't agree. I'll see you on the other side.
Wow. We've got a lot to talk about. Jesse, it's good to see you again. I reached out, of course, because of this latest plot that was just uncovered against the Michigan governor, Gretchen Whitmer. And I think, you know, it's helped making all of us really sit up and take notice just about the rising domestic terrorism threat that is going on in the country. And since you have a really unique perspective, having been on both sides of the equation as it relates to this issue, I wanted to get your perspective. And to start off our conversation, I want to share a quote. This is actually from a brief that was written by the Center for Strategic and International Studies by Seth Jones there. And here's what, this was written June 17th of 2020, this year. The United States faces a growing terrorism problem that will likely worsen over the next year. Based on a Center for Strategic and International Studies data set of terrorist incidents, the most significant threat likely comes from white supremacists, though anarchists and religious extremists inspired by the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda could present a potential threat as well. Over the rest of 2020, the terrorist threat in the United States will likely rise based on several factors, including the November 2020 presidential election. So, as someone who was a former recruiter for Al-Qaeda and who is now working to educate and help the counterterrorism experts know what the thinking is on the other side and how to unravel all that, tell me what your thoughts are about where we are and what we can expect.
Okay. Complicated question, but thank you very much for having me in these very serious times. I think it's very important to first understand that these things have been developing for a very long time. And I remember when I was sitting in a prison cell in the custody of the United States government in Alexandria Detention Center, where two UK citizens have just been extradited and are probably sitting in the same cells that I was. Due to their affiliations with ISIS. And I remember starting to grappling with the question of whether or not I should still continue to support Osama bin Laden and his ideology. it had brought such devastation into my life, and I had brought such devastation into other people's lives. And I had a dream one night that was pretty powerful. I won't narrate the details of it, but I woke up in a cold sweat because it was basically me asking Osama bin Laden, this is how much a man I never met was important to me, whether or not I was betraying the cause by having these ideas that I was wrong. And when I woke up, someone had slid an Economist magazine under my door. And the cover of the magazine was the magazine's addition to coincide with Osama bin Laden's assassination or killing in Abbottabad, Pakistan. So I was picked up in Morocco and incarcerated 2 weeks after Osama bin Laden was killed. And the cover of the Economist magazine had his image, and the title was perfect because it said, "Now kill his dream." And because the idea, while everyone else was celebrating that Osama bin Laden was dead as a human being and thinking that that was going to have some significance with regard to ending the war on terror, the Economist magazine hit it right on the head, that the idea was still alive and well in the hearts and minds of millions around the world.
Right.
And I say that to suggest that I think it's time we reflect on Osama bin Laden's strategy as a jihadist who now works with other former far-right-wing extremists, far-left-wing extremists, and understands how extremisms and radicalization intersects with one another in symbiotic but synergistic ways. It is safe to consider the fact that we have been lured into this trap by the war on terror that we were lured into with the attacks on September the 11th. So bin Laden's goal, and what we always consciously knew when we were radicalizing and recruiting for the jihadists, was that if we forced a narrative of Islamophobia, if we made Americans hate Muslims at large, or to exaggerate the numbers and make ourselves appear larger than we were, we could force a divide that would force the domestic ambit in the United States to fragment from within. And that was based upon a notion that bin Laden declared when we invaded Iraq in 2004. He came onto TV and he said, and he recorded a lecture that we can now see, a propaganda piece. And he said, "We're not fighting you because we hate your democracy, your human rights, or your way of life. We're fighting you for a foreign policy grievance, the fact that you interfere with politics in the Middle East. And we won't be able to get rid of the Arab dictatorships until we get rid of your ability to control the world order." He said that, "I'm waging a war of attrition against you like I waged a war of attrition against the Soviets in Afghanistan. And you will exhaust massive resources to fight my ideas. All I have to do is send two individuals anywhere in the world to wave the black flag of Al-Qaeda, and you will exhaust enormous military resources and treasure to go there to defeat that cause. And the money that you spend will benefit your multinational corporations, but it will deplete your people." And so the war on terror was a war of attrition that was meant to do the same thing that collapsed the USSR. The USSR was unable to provide services for its own people because it got embroiled in conflict in Afghanistan that served not just our interests in the United States, but the jihadist interests who were trying to galvanize and resurrect this notion of a global jihad. And what happened in Soviets, it took them 10 years, and bin Laden predicted it would take him 20 years to do it to us, was they had to increasingly allocate so much resource to fighting the war against the Afghan Mujahideen that they collapsed from within at home. They did not lose the battlefield. Defeat did not necessarily bankrupt the USSR in Afghanistan. What bankrupted the USSR was the consequences of having to allocate all their attention and their resource to that war. And I say that just to suggest that we need to preface this as part of a very larger paradigm, because in the context of George Bush's declaring in the aftermath of 9/11 that you're either with us or you're with the terrorists, we adopted a very binary way of looking at the world through blacks and whites that has now come to eat us alive at home. This did not start with the election of Donald Trump. It started with the beginning of the war on terror and the way that it massively changed our culture and led us down a trajectory of self-defeat. And I fear that we are well along the way and well along the path toward inducing that defeat. And so what we said when we would radicalize is we would look at variables that would show that if Americans receive information that Muslims blatantly dehumanize Americans, they're more likely to dehumanize the Muslims in return. And so what people would do that were espousing anti-Muslim tropes and narratives, they couldn't find anyone in the United States that actually wanted to advocate for bin Laden's views except my organization. But what we would do is we would manipulate the mainstream media so that we appeared as if we were representative.
Your organization being?
My organization was called Revolution Muslim. We were connected to 15 different terrorist plots in the United States. We transitioned the world to promoting Al-Qaeda's views in a way where Western audiences could understand them. We made it like Al-Qaeda on Madison Avenue or Al-Qaeda in Hollywood.
Okay, so help me connect the dots between Al-Qaeda and everything that you just articulated, that Osama bin Laden basically created a playbook to sow the discord that we are now doing. Mm-hmm. We're basically playing into the hands of the playbook. So connect those dots for me a little bit more clearly.
So we knew, and another group that I worked with, Adama Hajirun, one of the most notorious European-based radicalization pro-jihadi organizations, we knew that we needed to force polarization at home. So what we would do is we would do very flamboyant things to get on television and to get in documentary films. For example, one organization called Clarion Foundation made a film about during the uprun to Barack Obama's election as president that tried to portray him as a Muslim. And they tried to show that there are Muslims living in America that want to advocate for Sharia law. Well, they had no example of any organization that had actually called for such crazy claims, but they made a video that basically was shipped to, you know, tens of millions of American homes in districts that were contentious for left or right political representation that portrayed my organization as representative of the entirety of Muslim American perspectives. And we celebrated because we knew it was false. But with that Islamophobic sentiment manifested itself as one which it was at first anti-Muslim. And what it did was it drove the right into a frenzy that polarized it from the left. And it fed that narrative during the era of Obama. Okay. And then with having the first African-American president and then having the policies of the Obama administration not necessarily work out so well socioeconomically for many people, we see a confluence of variables that are a byproduct of creating that us versus them divide. But I say that to suggest not so much that it's important that that sentiment of Islamophobia seeded a major component of the polarization, the political, social, and cultural polarization that we see today, but that we are replicating it domestically now, right? So now what we have is we have a situation where we're receiving info that if we're on the left, we're receiving info that the guys on the right, dehumanize us, that everybody on the right is a white supremacist. Therefore, we need to fight against them because we're under threat. And if we're on the right and we're looking at the left, then all we see is Antifa and Black Lives Matter are socialists that want to change our way of life. They want to use violence to do so. Therefore, we're justified in our violence against them. And in the field I work in, we call this reciprocal radicalization that feeds into an underlying reciprocal dehumanization. And when people consider themselves not to be accepted as human beings by the other, and they split their world into black and white, us versus them, then they are more willing to commit violence against the other because they see themselves as defending themselves from a threat. Yeah. And so it's not just a difference. There's a very serious difference between feeling like someone dehumanizes you and feeling like somebody disagrees with you. And whereas at the onset of 9/11, America had, let's say, look at individual, you know, political perceptions that crossed the barrier between left and right. 49% of Americans held independent views that were partially Democratic, partially Republican. Those have been reduced to 30% now. The feelings of the other political party have been exaggerated to the degree where now we have a large portion, 30% of our society would be upset if their child married someone from another political party. Right, all of these, this is really an indicator of the polarization, but the paradigm is polarization as it hyperpolarizes, creates reciprocal dehumanization, which creates radicalization on both fringes, which feed each other reciprocal radicalization, which then if you have a very low base rate of radicalized individuals that go on to commit violent extremism, if you increase the number of radicals, you increase the number of those that commit violence. And so we have a very serious.
So I was going to say, yeah, so we have a very serious problem, and everything you just described is exactly where we are right now. So we have, we have most recently seen this plot against the Michigan governor. There's a lot of talk among folks who are working in the anti-terrorism community that says, get ready, folks, because, you know, there are going to be more plots that are either uncovered or that come to fulfillment, because there are literally hundreds of them that are under investigation. And I know you're working in the space. So what are you seeing and hearing? What's the chatter behind the scenes? And then what can we do to start to combat this? So first of all, what's going on behind the scenes?
So we have a serious problem, because a lot of what we did with regard to counter violent extremism from jihadists was counterproductive. So what it did was we started to intervene and think that the ideas that they held were the primary problem. And we brought the wrong messengers, the wrong message, and the wrong medium to connect to counter them. And we might have made the problem worse, but that's not the most important variable, because American Muslim community represents 1% of our population. And now we're dealing with people that represent 15 to 20% of our population. So you can imagine that as the threat of jihadist violence went up, FBI was overwhelmed with monitoring jihadist cases around the country. At one point during the peak of ISIS, there were several thousand investigations going on at one time. And the FBI director stated that it was overwhelming their field offices. Now you can imagine, apply that 2000 number and take it tenfold at least. And you're looking at the number of investigations that the FBI is responsible for, not to mention the fact that the law enforcement community has been so predominantly overwhelmed with a concentration on jihadism.
So that 2000, so that number that you're saying to multiply, is that, is that the number of investigations on the domestic front, or is that combined with?
You would have to, if we had the proper allocation of resources, I would say that just with the far right, there's at least 20 to 50,000 individuals in our country that are worthy of showing risk indicators that could one day transform into violent extremist behavior, that support, defend, promote, and are willing to mobilize and die for a far right wing cause. And that's proportionately of magnitude higher than we ever dealt with jihadism. And so, and the problem really is that even the far right doesn't even want to preserve any longer our country as it exists. A lot of it is anti-government extremism, the likes of which we saw in this case. Yeah. And so far left and far right, the extremist fringes are both anti-government in a way where their ultimate cause and objective is to destroy the system that we live under.
And so this is, I'm going to interrupt you just for 1 second, because this feeds into the next quote from the same article that I wanted to share and continue the conversation from there. And again, this is from the Center for Strategic and International Studies on June 17th of this year. Our data suggests that right-wing extremists pose the most significant terrorism threat to the United States based on annual terrorist events and fatalities. Over the next year, the threat of terrorism in the U.S. will likely increase based on several factors, such as the November 2020 presidential election and the response to the COVID-19 crisis. These factors are not the cause of terrorism, but they are events and developments likely to fuel anger and be co-opted by a small minority of extremists as a pretext for violence. And you're saying that that minority of extremists is actually in the realm of perhaps 50,000 people in the United States on the far right side. We're not talking about far left at this moment, right? Yeah.
Yes. I mean, the far left and their extremism is not necessarily the same as far as like killing civilians, you know, on the street deliberately to obtain a cause. That's terrorism. But political violent extremism has to be expanded to include property damage, to include other aspects that maybe the far left fulfill. But the real true threat of terrorism, really, we have to seriously say, is white supremacist, far right wing extremists. And that has to be made clear. But I give credit to CSIS and Seth Jones in particular, who heads a really good outfit there in understanding these dynamics, because it's not just about the far right. We have to start to think about how we feed in, they feed into each other, far left and far right, and how that creates a void that can also remobilize and reassert and resurrect the jihadist threat as well. And so we're looking at just intersecting extremisms that are benefiting from each other in symbiotic ways, where if I need an enemy to justify an attack, I can find my enemy in Antifa today greater than I ever could. And if I am a far leftist that needs to justify an attack or to act out and lash out in violence and needs an idea to do so, I can find a far right wing extremist who justifies the idea that I have in my head. So the narratives of the other are important. It's not just about who we are, whoever we associate ourselves with. It's it's not just about who they are, the other, right. the outgroup. It's about who right. we are as well. And that's really the secret and to the, coming and the, to conclusions.
And the basis of all of these narratives lies in our dehumanization of each other.
Yes.
That's where it starts. Go ahead.
Yes. As a culture, we have lost an ability to connect to our humanity for a number of reasons. The overwhelming use of the smartphone and the concentration of being able to have dual identities, one in the real world, one online on social media, has mm-hmm. detached ourselves from our bodies. Our minds mm-hmm. exist in a space that is a parallel network to our real world existences. And oftentimes they're two very completely different personas. When it right. comes to culture and when it comes to communications and the media we take in, we tend to involve ourselves in echo chambers where we only hear a view that is sympathetic to our own. We don't get outside of our own box. And we've also developed sensitivities to being in put into contact with what we're calling now triggering voices. So we don't have the ability to sit down and communicate and hear things that make us uncomfortable anymore. And at the end of the day, we feel like if people were just prohibited from speaking uncomfortable things, that we would feel better about ourselves. But in actuality, what that really does to you is it means that in your mind, whether you realize it or not, you don't legitimize the other person's right to exist. And it works on both sides of the aisle. We have to recognize that we might disagree with another, but if we can just paint in some empathy, that's the gateway to rehumanization. I know this from a personal level, but we also now are starting to study it on a collective level. We have to have, it's what some people say, just talk to the other side and create opportunities for dialogue. That can really just cement views. What we have to do is we have to come up with ways to change our culture. Our culture has deteriorated. It has gone to materialism and consumerism to the utmost degree, to the point where that deep need that individuals have for meaning, significance, and purpose, and art and creativity for being able to create a space of community where individuals are attacking problems at a higher order of consciousness. The mm-hmm. cult, the constant progression of the democratic experiment is now endangered. And it might even have noble causes behind it. But the reality is that the principles, while they're not perfect, that we have built the American system and thereby the liberal world order on, are now being called into question. But they've been tested for time immemorial as best practices. And yes, there's a lot of structural inequalities. There's a lot of problems. But if we don't work within the system, we'll create a system that's even worse and more oppressive, which is typically what happens when radicalized ideas see their day in fruition. It's very easy to complain about what exists now, but you see defund the police, destroy, you know, tear down racism, tear down every verb added to the cause is one of destruction. It's not one right. of let's transform.
Right. Let's transform. Right? Let's bring together. Yep. Right. Yeah.
Yep. We have to change the language and we have to speak in a way that's empowering. And we have to look at everybody as a human being. We don't have to have sympathy. Right. And we should have empathy, but we don't necessarily even have to have empathy. But we do have to remember that it's consciousness that separates us from the rest of the creation.
So, Jesse, let me ask you this. I want to kind of connect this to your history and your background. And for sure. those of you who are watching and listening, I urge you to go back and look at the very first interview that I did with Jesse. This is now the third one. But in that first interview, he goes into significant detail about his history and his background and, you know, how he grew up and basically the dynamics of his childhood that helped lead him to a point where he could be radicalized to the point where he became a recruiter for Al-Qaeda. So please go back and look at that interview. But Jesse, what I want to ask you now is how, you know, it's easy to say we need to change our culture. And you just gave some examples of how we can do that by changing the language from the language of the destructive to the language of the constructive and bringing us together and transforming, et cetera. But in real terms, how does one take the steps that you took to go from being a radical jihadist to now working to fight radical extremism on the domestic and the international front? How much time did it take? And what are the concrete steps that we can do right now to start to reconnect with our fellow humans and get to empathy?
Very good. So one of the things that I have learned from my own personal experience is that everybody's process is individualized, and that we're all very unique individuals, but that there are milestone markers along the way that we now call our paradigm for individual and collective alteration. So this paradigm that I'll describe to you very briefly is what drives our counter-narrative work. It drives our intervention work with people that are in extremist movements, and it drives our way of trying to take what happens at the micro, connecting it to the meso, and then connecting it to an ability to come back at the realm of prevention and influence the macro. And we call it our control, alt, delete, hate paradigm for personal and collective change. I first had to learn how to control the space between stimulus and response. When people are in a traumatized state, they can't do that because they exist in a state of fight, flight, or freeze. And any external stimuli that makes them uncomfortable and challenges what they're committed to makes them either fear and run away, or fight and argue and turn violent to extremism, or freeze and stay stuck, inundated with this trauma. And anybody who is in an extremist movement might not have been traumatized, but it is traumatizing to exist in that state of mind for any prolonged period of time. So you have to control the space between stimulus and response, as Viktor Frankl said, that there's a space between stimulus and response. And in that space lies human beings' power to transform. So we get people to pause and to talk about the cognitive bias, to look at confirmation bias and how we're looking at echo chambers and you're cherry picking data. If we can just get them to sit with us long enough and give us a chance. And that takes the mind into a state of not being in fight, flight, or freeze. We can get them to pause. And when we can get them to pause, we can give them a hug, and we can give them love, and we can give them empathy. We can give them compassion, and we can give them all of what they deserve as human beings without necessarily agreeing what they once were. And I got that from people because I was fortunate enough, without any formal programming, to run into beautiful people in Morocco that were millennial Arab youth, and then a former jihadist who was incarcerated in a Casablancan prison, and then the FBI, who wasn't waging a war against Islam and who was very empathetic and understanding to me. And then from society as a whole, as I've continued my progress and trek. And so the control space goes to alt. And once you give someone love, you can get them to make that commitment to nonviolence, that violence is futile, that all of revolutionary violence only leads to more destruction. If they commit to nonviolence.
So let me stop you there. So if I'm hearing you correctly, I want to take this to a one-on-one level just for the average person who's out there watching or listening. Okay. So, So you've got a family member or a friend who is a polar opposite, and you guys are, you know, you're butting heads. Mm-hmm. And you're saying if I have a family member or a friend that I don't understand why you think the way you do. And if you're saying, if I can get that person to pause, and also if I can get myself to pause, right?
Yes. Yes.
To pause, and give each other some love and some respect, and then come back at the topic at hand. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. And from a neuroscientific perspective of what we know about us versus them thinking, this is how you do it. You have to paint in criticism of your own group, and you have to show something that you can find that is human in the outgroup.
Right.
And what that does is it starts to show empathy. So what it does in their brain is it doesn't put them on the defensive. Right. So you can find something you agree with And as long as you can show them that you're not dehumanizing them, what that will happen is it takes them out of fight, flight, freeze. It takes them into a state where they can make calm, deliberate decisions. And in the realm of, you know, psychology or decision-making under uncertainty, school of thought, Daniel Kahneman's school of thought, for example, talks about fast thinking and slow thinking, type one and type two thinking. You want to take people, you want to create a space free of hate. And you do that by being acknowledging of your own shortcomings and also showing empathy to another individual you disagree with. Now the space has changed. And that's when you can show love and the humanity returns to the room. We do not, college campuses, high schools, political protest communities, the protests that are going on where young people are yelling at cops and saying, you know, screw you, pig, you know, we're going to, you know, and assuming that every cop, you know, all of this is not a space that's in that state of existence. It's all trauma, collective trauma, fight, flight, freeze. You have to show one piece of empathy in and immediately if you use it and practice it in your life. I remember when the FBI agent turned to me when I first changed. And there was a male agent who was criticizing me for continuing to publish political articles from solitary confinement in jail. And the woman, the FBI agent, said, well, I read your articles and I think they're fascinating. You're a very good writer. And immediately my brain went, bad cop, good cop, or that's a human being who sees that I'm somebody. And the number of lives that were saved as a result of that statement, just that one statement, can't really even be quantified at this point, because I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for that one moment that will stay with me for the rest of my life. We have to create moments like that. I work with the NYPD director of intelligence that monitored me for years, and he has been the most father-like figure I have ever had in my life, just from modeling what it means to be an upstanding man. When people in the community of countering violent extremism, where there's a high level of competition for limited resources, try to use and abuse the vulnerable like myself, he says we act on higher principle than that. That's what we're about. That's what we're in this for. That's creating that space. We have to create space like that. And if we do it on an individual level, then we'll start to slowly be able to unwind the process. We're not going to unelect Donald Trump and fix our problem.
You know, everything you just said gave me chills, because it's such a beautiful example of how one person, one moment, one sentence can change everything, can change a dynamic to the point where, you know, you start to see someone else's humanity because they took a moment to see yours. And that's what this podcast is always been about from the very beginning. It's why I started in the first place, is to try to have conversations like this and to have uncomfortable conversations where people literally come together and have a conversation like the one we're talking about. So if you have another, you know, hands-on piece of strategy that we can use as individuals to help get us to reminding us of our common humanity, please share that. And then I want to ask about what your thoughts are about our future.
Well, there's many examples every day where, by showing this practice, by being able to see the humanity in people that are otherwise hated and feel the entire society hates them, but actually feel that they're justified in believing in what they believe. We have breakthrough conversations every day that show this. You know, that see it. We don't have enough resources to scale our operations up high enough to meet the demand. But one thing I can say is that we did learn a lesson from the war against the jihadists previously, where CVE, Countering Violent Extremism, focused on them. And that is that you cannot arrest your way out of a problem. And with this reality that law enforcement agencies are going to be inundated, we have to learn how to connect the dots between reciprocal dehumanization, increasing radicalization, and then from there, the violent extremist actors that represent fringes of those radical movements. And the only way we'll ever be able to do it is to just understand what we know from science And that's the beautiful thing about the world that we live in. We know so much, but practice so little. We are sitting on the opportunity in crises can occur. We have all we need to know to transform into a trauma-conscious society that understands how traumas, not just bad experiences, but collective trauma of being bewildered and being polarized and having socioeconomic, you know, wealth inequality exacerbating and all the things that have been going on for 20 years. We know that the consequences are more violence, but we have at our, anytime we want it, we can create a paradigm shift that completely transforms everything from policing to education to psychology to countering violent extremism. What we're learning about the manifestation of trauma, collective and individual trauma, gives us the gateways. And so every day we're applying trauma-informed practices into dealing with individuals so that they feel like they are worth and that they are not animals and that they are humans. And all we need to do is impart a better understanding of the science behind it and what it looks like in practice. And we will be okay. So we have the knowledge. But knowledge without implementation is not knowledge. You know, there's four types of people. You know, there's a person who knows and knows that he knows. He's a scholar. We ask him information. Then there's an individual. He doesn't. He knows, but he doesn't know, but he knows that he doesn't know. And that's a student. And we have way too many chiefs, not enough Indians. And then there's a person who knows, but he doesn't know that he knows. We all know what it means to be a human. We just need to be woken up. But unfortunately, most of us are in that fourth category, and that's a person who doesn't know, but he doesn't know that he doesn't know. And he's a fool. You have to stay away from him. Unfortunately, we typically elect them to be presidents and representatives of our republic at this point. And that's the unfortunate thing that needs to change. If we can change the culture, change the consciousness, and learn how to deal with the traumas that are impacting us all. We're all traumatized from quarantine.
Yeah, I was just going to say the collective trauma currently is COVID. And
yeah, we have PTSD.
Yeah.
We have PTSD collectively and individually. We need post-traumatic growth and we know how to get there. And we need to all work together and unite. And we need to build a movement that's based upon love, compassion, empathy, and reaching out across the aisle and saying, even though I disagree with you staunchly, I love you because you're a human being and I have compassion for you because it's hard to be human. But we can get through this together.
Do you think we will? What is your gut telling you about the future of American democracy?
My personal life experience has taught me that those that are most hateful can be the most beneficial in advocating for love and compassion, that in order to grow, sometimes we have to hurt. And that sometimes period of decline, I am astounded by the resiliency of the human spirit and soul. And I am astounded by the resiliency, no matter how imperfect, of this American experiment, this democratic experiment that founding fathers who, yes, indeed had some contradictions, built principles that have produced quite alarming paradigmatic shifts in the structures of human beings all over this globe. I like to think that this is a wake-up call and that we'll get through this. But I know that the beauty of it is, even if you fail in the course of trying, and I've been working at this issue and addressing this issue now for several years of my life, every day, oftentimes 12, 14-hour days, 7 days a week. But I have been met by some of the most fascinating individuals and some of the most loving and compassionate individuals. And it's about that quest and meeting those people that gives you that hope. So we have to change why we live. What is our purpose in life? We have to ask ourselves, what is your purpose? And now we have a purpose. And the purpose is not to save something or destroy something. The purpose is to climb higher collectively as human beings and to find out that we are all human. Therefore, we are all one tribe. Doesn't matter what flag we wave, doesn't matter what group we belong to. At our core, we are all so much more similar than we are different. And if I know what it's like to hurt inside of me, then I should certainly be able to look at you or any other individual on the planet and understand what it must feel like to hurt inside of them. That makes us bound. And that makes my success contingent upon the success of everyone else on the planet. And those are the attitudes that are very real. And I have constantly been checked with feelings of hopelessness in my own journey, and constantly been faced with things that made it look like everything would fall apart, and jarred back into fight, flight, or freeze, only to find out that if I just pause and I learn how to exercise that space between stimulus and response, and I don't respond as I am being treated, and I respond at a higher order of consciousness, everything works out the way it was supposed to be. We tend to call that faith, but it doesn't matter what you call it. There's a divine principle at work in the universe. And if we can just tap back into that divine principle and awaken our souls and ourselves up to be astutely aware human beings, conscious as we walk through the day, as far as what is really important in life, what is the legacy I'm going to leave behind? Is it going to be a good one, or is it going to destroy? Is it going to seek to destroy something? Is it going to seek to contribute to love? Is it going to concentrate on what's around me that I can love every day? Or am I going to sacrifice myself like I once did, sacrifice my own children, being with my children for 3.5 years of their life for a cause that I could do nothing about, not realizing that the things that I could love and the things that I could nurture and the things that I could experience love and compassion from were right there in front of me the whole time. I think that's the element of truth we need to start to convey and hopefully trickle from one to one, each one teach one, to operations of magnitudinal exponential growth. There's a lot of people that feel the same way. We just need to mobilize them in the same way that the extremists are mobilizing against us.
Yes. Well, your voice is an important one in mobilizing this movement and helping us understand how we can embrace our common humanity. Jesse Morton, thank you so much. We will make sure that in the show notes, we link to your organization, Parallel Networks, and the new center that you have going on. And I know there's so much more we could talk about the work that you're now doing in the prison system. And I will continue to reach out to you to have these conversations. I think you bring so much to the table, and I really appreciate you taking the time to talk about this today.
Thank you so much. I'm honored. And be well and continue to do the beautiful work that you do.
Thanks, thank you. Jesse. You be well, too.
God bless. God bless. Godspeed. Thanks.
If you remember nothing else from the conversation that I just had with Jesse, please remember this. Pause. Take that deep breath. Before you speak, before you act, when you're engaging with someone that you don't agree with. And remember, they are also a human being. Thank you for giving Jesse Morton permission to speak and for having the courage to listen with an open mind. Please keep love in your heart and go out and vote. We'll see you next time.